day, he and Smith had presented testimony from two other firefighters and the three police officers who'd arrived before the bodies were found. But they didn't summon John Jones, who, after all, was the first homicide detective on the scene and the investigation's original case agent. When asked why not, Jones just shrugs. They didn't know what I'd say. Instead, they depended on others, like Joe Pennington, whose diagrams established the positions of the bodies, and Irma Rios, whom Smith walked carefully through the crime scene, asking her what she was seeing now, and now. As they continued together from the dining area into the storage room, past the melted telephone, the bucket, the mop, the sink, the door to the walk-in cooler, past the body of Amy on the table where the girls often counted up the day's receipts. Irma Rios did not make life easy for Smith. When asked if she'd noticed any special marks on Amy, she said she hadn't, except for a stain on her cheek that, no, she hadn't recognized as an exit wound from a .380 cartridge. Gunshot evidence was not her department. And no, she hadn't known the girls had been shot. She hadn't looked. One photograph shows her in the storage room in white tennis shoes and a little red sweater, holding a flashlight and looking for all the world like a woman who has no idea what she's doing, but is improvising nonetheless. Responding to a question about the debris, she said, "The big items, we were just putting them up onto the shelves, so we removed those so we could find the bigger items. The other one was just going right through onto the ground. Again, it was like mush or ashes. Basically, that's all it was. It was not anything large because we have sifters. It's almost like a chicken-type wire on there. And we're just putting debris in and we're sifting it and using the hose. The reason we're using the hose is because it's wet and it's mush, so we can't sift it anymore. It's not dry." Within 2 years of this trial, Irma Rios would be hired by the Houston Police Department to run its discredited crime lab when thousands of pieces of forensic evidence, including swabs for DNA tests, rape kits, and articles of clothing, had been discovered on its shelves, untested, and in many instances gone stale and useless. After shutting down the lab and firing its director, HPD had farmed out that work for a while, and then hired Rios. But within 5 years of her arrival, another inspection revealed some 4,000 untested rape kits. The city had to close the lab again, though Rios managed to hold on to her job. On cross, Sawyer went to town on her. Had she kept a log of who came and went? No. Was there a manual of protocols? Not really. Had they examined the contents of the dumpsters in the alley? They'd looked at what was on top. Sawyer reserved the right to recall her on direct. Reese Price provided Bryce's rules regarding the closing of the shop and the handling of the night's take. A dependably strong witness for the state, when asked to describe the back door lock, she stuck to her original response. She couldn't remember. The next day, a well-rehearsed Melvin Stahl described his arrival at the scene and acknowledged that, yes, he and Mike Huckabee and Chuck Meyer had all agreed that the fire originated on one of the melted storage shelves near the back doors. However, he said, after recently examining photographs taken that night, he'd revised his opinion. Again, Jones wasn't mentioned, nor was the fact that Stahl himself had taken the photographs. But when questioned by Sawyer on cross, he had to concede that, yes, his change of mind about the fire's origin came after the four boys' arrest, after Mike Scott's confession, and after Marshall Littleton had come up with a theory that agreed with it. Littleton himself then took several hours to explain how he'd come by the new analysis. Under cross, he admitted that, yes, He had fed the wrong ceiling height into his computer, but that all he'd had to do was go to the shop and count the cement blocks to correct it. He'd then gone back to his office and rebooted his software. By the next day, using a higher estimate for the ceiling, he'd made his theory work. Outside the presence of the jury, Sawyer took a last-ditch stand against the use of the enhanced videotape of his client's confession. "I think," he said, "we have increasingly become a culture that ascribes greater reality to broadcast video images than things we hear or read, and that because a transcription had been added to what was already enhanced, it delivered a more immediate suggestion of trustworthiness than freestanding images alone would convey, and therefore stacked the deck in the state's favor." And he wondered why, in a courtroom setting when a man's life was at stake, the printout, in essence, a version of the Springsteen interrogation that the cops had transcribed as best they could remember, should be admissible. The plea was interesting and not entirely fruitless. Lynch agreed to instruct the jury that while the videotape was evidence, the transcript, having been prepared by the state of Texas for its own use, was not. If jurors noted any variance between the two, they should trust the videotape. At the end of each day, they would return the transcriptions the court had given them and would not be allowed to review them during final deliberations. So the jury would listen to a sometimes undecipherable audio recording superimposed on a murky videotape, accompanied by a guesswork transcription that was possibly biased. Appropriation artists and folklorists call this kind of media stew a recontextualization, while musicians and computer techies prefer either the term mixtape or mashup. In any case, the DA's gamble was that jurors tend to trust policemen's memories more than those of indicted suspects. During a criminal trial, the defendant sits with his back to the spectators, and unless he turns toward them, they don't see much beyond the occasional glimpse of his profile. Lynch sometimes allowed an officially appointed press photographer to snap a few photos before the jury came in. Entering the courtroom, Springsteen carried himself high, swinging his arms in a wide, confident arc, his chin lifted and cocked to one side. Most defendants dress for the occasion, as if for an office job, dress shirt, tie, sport coat. But Rob wore either a long-sleeved button-down shirt or a dark short-sleeved one, along with khaki pants. Still ashen and slightly heavy, he'd had his hair cut in a defiant buzz that emphasized the deep V's of his widow's peak, his bad skin and receding hairline, those wispy sideburns, and lifted know-it-all eyebrows. Except when whispering to his attorneys, he'd been silent as a rock since entering his plea. Once the videotape had been loaded, the state called Robert Merrill, and Smith opened his direct examination with some standard setup questions. Had he worn a gun in the interview room? No, left it in his fanny pack in an office somewhere. Why hadn't he immediately issued a Miranda warning? The suspect was not in custody. Had the billboard photos of the four girls been shown to the defendant when he was questioned back in 1991? Yes. After Lynch reminded the jury that statements by officers conducting the interrogation were not to be considered the truth, but were admitted to provide possible context for the defendant's statements, the bailiff handed out the transcripts and had the lights dimmed. The videotape opened with the white room, then Lada, and in no time Merrill and Rob, who stood loose-limbed and polite in front of his chair, looking around, saying yes, sir, and thank you, and when Lada entered, he offered him his hand. Then came the moment with the cigarette and the no-smoking conversation, and Springsteen saying, "Hey, no problem," and taking his seat. During the early gum-chewing portion of the interview, he would place his right ankle on his left knee and swing his knees back and forth, not nervously, just out of habit. Sawyer's earlier statement about the power of film and video made a valid point. When we see people on television or in a movie, we think we know them. On May 15, 2001, while the actual defendant remained mute and all but faceless to jurors and spectators, the unsuspecting Robbie of 19 months ago was about to appear before them as a virtual presence, alive, speaking, moving, animated, real. Years from now, onlookers might well remember the tape with more clarity than the sight of Springsteen himself. They might run the tape in their minds and, hearing his voice, wonder what it was like to sit at the defense table, watching a younger version of himself dig his own grave. While the videos ran, Lynch consulted his laptop, checking relevant laws and court decisions. Keeping an eye on his jury, he was careful to interrupt the proceedings regularly to give them long breaks. By the time Rob uttered the line about putting his dick in Amy Ayers' pussy, the Nagra tape had run out, and so his words were extremely difficult to make out, despite the enhancement, especially if you didn't know what was coming. But the jury had it spelled out right there on their laps. Minutes later, when he got it wrong about the guns, Merrill read him his rights, and Rob finally left. Lights up. Court adjourned. Families were hopeful. The prosecution pleased. When confronted by the press, Sawyer assured them that during cross he would question the tape line by line. Springsteen returned to county jail, thinking his goose was probably cooked. But the state wasn't finished with Merrill or the taped confession, and the next day Smith recalled the detective and asked why interrogated suspects sometimes gave answers that minimized their participation and blamed others. Merrill said he didn't know why. It's just what happens. Often? Yes. Was this suspect under arrest? No, sir. Did the detectives tell him he was free to go? Yes, sir. Did any officer bring a gun into the interview room? No, sir. The prosecution then began playing repeated 3 to 10 minute clips of the questioning, afterward asking Merrill to explain their significance. Here is an example. Question. Detective Merrill, we watched a clip here where you tell him that he is just as much a victim as anybody else. Do you recall that? Answer. Yes, I do. Question. In fact, he indicates that Maurice went something like apeshit. Do you recall that? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And at the end there, you say to him, if you haven't figured it out, Maurice blames you. Do you recall that? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Can you tell us what you're doing there during that portion of the interview? Answer. I'm trying to make Maurice the bad guy, the real bad guy, and him as the victim. Let him be the victim here. Let him think we believe that, and start getting to what actually happened. Question. Earlier in that clip, he had said, when he was talking about being out in the parking lot, Maurice and Forrest ran in to get something, and, quote, something, something, something. Do you recall that phrase? Answer. Yes, I do. Question. And you saw him use that throughout the interview, this little something, something, something phrase? Answer. That's correct. Question. Is that significant to you? Answer. We find that in an interview, if they are using something, 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 you know, yada, 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 they know what they want to say or what's there. They just don't want to say it yet. Question. Thank you. Next clip. After 2 hours of this, Sawyer had had enough. If the prosecution wanted to replay the entire tape, they should do so because at the present, all we are doing is re-emphasizing the state's greatest hits. Lynch overruled. If Sawyer wanted the jury to see the whole tape again, he could run it himself. Later that morning, in his cross-examination of Merrill, Sawyer touched on Reed and the deceptive practices of the APD. But as usual, the officer faced hostile questions head-on, without trying to second-guess, subtext, or figure out what he should say. His answers were blunt and unapologetic, even when Sawyer called him a liar. "Yes, sir," Merrill will say, "he did do that. He lied." And yes, sir, Lara and Chuck Meyer also lied. "That is correct." But when Sawyer asked why he'd ended the interview before getting everything they wanted, Merrill lost some of his usual composure. "It was time," was all he'd say, even though it clearly wasn't. When asked about the cops' slip-up, other defense lawyers say they have no idea why it happened, and neither, more than likely, did Merrill. In preparation for a favorable decision allowing them to present Mike Scott's redacted statement, prosecutors spent the better part of 2 days placing the co-defendants, along with Pierce and Wellborn, together at McCallum, the bowling alley, North Cross, and in the stolen Pathfinder. To accomplish this, they brought in friends of the boys, including the one Rob was supposed to have met up with at the Rocky show, and later on, their star witness, Chandra Morgan, 13 at the time, who acknowledged to Darla Davis that, yes, she'd dropped acid that night, but nevertheless remembered the boys riding around in Maurice's beat-up, dirty two-door gray Honda. And him doing acid in the parking lot, and a gun poking from the waistband of Springsteen's jeans, and... Her testimony went on. But in Sawyer's words, her manner was that of a woman underwater, and she got so many things wrong, her usefulness to the state was negligible. Robert Smith next called Rob's father, who didn't remember making a call to report his missing son, even after the Teleserve officer took the stand to read her account aloud. And in the end, so what if he had reported his son missing, or Maurice Pierce and his pals had gone to North Cross? And maybe they had been all messed up with drugs and beer and had taken a Pathfinder on a joyride to San Antonio, and Maurice had packed a .22 revolver, so the state had presented a story that might play. After the verdict, Springsteen jurors will say they were still on the fence at this time, even after watching the interrogation video. Lynch was meeting regularly with Bettis, Sawyer, and Smith in chambers, hacking out a decision on the Scott statement. When the state first told him it intended to offer a redacted version, the judge's immediate response was, "No way." But Smith kept pushing. And at one session, an incredulous defense lawyer has sworn to me, he told Lynch, "Dude, I need it." "Dude? Really? We call the judge dude?" And was "I need it" enough to convince a sitting judge to yield? In any case, Lynch began to soften. He reread relevant Supreme Court cases from 1895 to 1998, as well as rulings from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And, little by little, this seasoned, intelligent judge convinced himself that a statement that was truly self-inculpatory to the declarant and not directly implicating the accused on trial could be admitted as an exception to the hearsay rule and not run afoul of the Sixth Amendment. The night before delivering his ruling, he took to his thinking couch, a long, low sofa in his chambers. Lynch's blue eyes turned slightly wistful when he remembers making the decision. "I thought it had a chance to go to the Supreme Court," he says now. "If Crawford hadn't come down when it did, it might have." And later, with some regret, I always said if Scalia ever got in the majority. Lawyers in town simply say he shouldn't have done it. And when offered a yes-but explanation, they shake their heads. Shouldn't have anyway. After reading the state's edits, he made further cuts, omitting all first-person pronouns, changing, "I believe that she was working in the back room when we entered," to the oddly impersonal, "believe that she was working in the back room." Early Friday morning, May 18th, he gave the final draft to his assistant, who, because the Supreme Court had ruled that blacked-out names and phrases only made obvious what had been omitted, typed it up as if nothing had been left out. Lynch then met with the relevant lawyers to relay his decision, and after lunch he gave the jury a 30-minute break, and, in a rambling statement for the record, explained why he was overruling the defense's motion to suppress Scott's statement. He then took on the objections one by one. Hearsay overruled because of a court-defined exception allowing for the admission of a statement that was entirely self-inculpatory and against penal interest, legalese for against one's interest in staying out of prison, with no mention of a co-defendant as a participant, an omission that gave it the necessary indicia of reliability and trustworthiness. And if it acknowledged only Scott's participation in the murders without accusing Robert Springsteen, the confrontation clause would be satisfied. As for voluntariness, he noted Scott's willingness to meet with detectives time and again, even helping out with their recording equipment. Regarding relevance, when the judge placed Springsteen's statement side by side with Scott's, he found 16 points of consistency and 8 of actual evidence, satisfying that question as well. Thus, objection overruled. State's Exhibit 377 allowed. Sawyer, regarding Lynch's decision, "My heart sank." Rob, "That was it for me." John Jones, "I was shocked. I thought you couldn't do that." Sawyer, "I told Lynch it would be overturned, even without Crawford." Garcia, "No way it was going to stand." Other attorneys called it a ballsy move, but wrong, ill-timed, even shocking. Mike Lynch's unfathomable mistake. When the jury returned, Manuel Fuentes was called to read the edited version aloud. After the verdict, a juror will call Scott's confession the key piece of evidence, the one that struck a chord with the jury. Another will say, "We knew things had gone really, really bad when the judge allowed that detective to get on the stand and read the statement. We felt some sort of fundamental shift in the atmosphere of the jury, the courtroom, and everything else after they allowed that to come in." They weren't aware, of course, that Judge Lynch had just taken the first step toward the reversal of the State of Texas v. Robert Burns Springsteen IV, or that in 2002, when he allowed a paraphrased version of Springsteen's taped confession to be read to the jury in the Michael Scott trial, he would set himself up to be overturned again. Michael Scott's redacted statement is included at the end of this audiobook as Appendix 2. 15 years later, Sawyer's memory of that day remains vivid. It was a Friday. After the Scott statement was read, Lynch excused the jury early and then asked to see Robert Smith and myself in his chambers, nobody else. He says that when he and the prosecutor arrived, Lynch was sitting with his feet up on his desk, smiling. "Gentlemen," he quotes the judge as having said, "this trial is about to be over." Smith then offered Robert Springsteen a very tasty deal. If he'd agree to a plea of guilty and then give testimony against the others, they'd take the death penalty off the table and offer him a life sentence of no more than 14 years, which, with time served and a state-supported early parole, meant about 8 more years of imprisonment. Sawyer was impressed. It was indeed a fine offer. He said he'd consult with his client. The next morning, he and Burke Bettis went to the county jail and presented the deal to Springsteen. He would, they told him, still be in his 30s when he got out, his whole life ahead of him. The boss, Sawyer often refers to his client that way, after the rock and roll singer, looked at me and said, "Would I have to testify against the other guys?" Reliving the scene, Sawyer turns up the volume. "I said, of course you will. What do you think?" But Springsteen refused. "Those guys," he said, "didn't do anything wrong, and he didn't either, but he got himself into this mess, so he'll have to get himself out." And when Sawyer warned him that he thought the jury would likely find him guilty and send him to death row, Robert said, "Fine, let them kill me. I won't do it." If Sawyer and Bettis had lingering doubts about their client's innocence, they vanished that morning. That's how Sawyer remembers it, and he thinks this was the state's plan all along, to use the reading of Scott's statement as leverage in order to end the trial. That way, they wouldn't have to argue in favor of executing a man without a sliver of evidence linking him to the crime. Mike Lynch confirms some of Sawyer's account. "Yes," he says, "he did confer with the lawyers in chambers on occasion to discuss non-substantive issues like logistics." On the other hand, he doesn't specifically remember this particular meeting or making the comment about the trial coming to an end. And while he has a vague memory of an offer made by the state, and says Sawyer could be right about how it came about, he's pretty sure he had no advanced knowledge of it. But he certainly would have supported efforts to settle the case, and yes, would have had his feet up on the desk. If Earl and Smith did pursue this plan to end Springsteen, they gave up on it. Michael Scott was not offered a deal after a paraphrased version of Rob Springsteen's confession was read during his trial. Monday morning, Sawyer informed the judge and the prosecutor of Springsteen's decision, and the trial continued. On the 10th day after putting on a few more witnesses, the state rested its case. Sawyer began his defense by calling Hector Polanco. Why? "Because," Sawyer declared without hesitation, "he's the most effective cop witness I've ever seen in a courtroom. He was handsome, dangerous, with black eyes, a fine mustache, and a roguish burglar's charm, and he talked directly to the jury. Everything he did to convince a suspect to confess to a crime he hadn't committed could work just as persuasively, whether for the defense or the prosecution, on the witness stand." After establishing the detective's credentials, Sawyer led him through a summary of his career that included such questions as, "You have never used coercion, threats, duress of any kind to achieve any of the hundreds of confessions you have developed during the time you were in homicide, did you, ever?" Polanco, "I have been accused of it, but no." Sawyer then asked him to talk about contamination of a crime scene and what happened when too much information reached the streets. Sometimes innocent people who heard things actually confessed, didn't they? Polanco said it might seem incredible, but yes, it happened. To drive the point home, Sawyer described an investigation some years ago when the husband of a woman who'd been reported missing was brought in for questioning. With the suspect's family present, Polanco shamed the man until he confessed to his wife's murder and agreed to lead APD officers with shovels and dogs to a field where he'd buried her. But before they started to dig, the wife called her husband's mobile number to ask why he said he'd killed her. It's a fine story, and Polanco confirmed it. But Darla Davis objected on grounds of relevance, and after Lynch sustained the objection, he cautioned Sawyer not to bring any more dead fish into his courtroom. After agreeing to stay within the dead fish limit, Sawyer asked Polanco what he thought about allowing television cameras to roam at will around the perimeter of the ICBY crime scene, and, later, the decision to give 48 hours full access to an open investigation. Polanco said that personally, he thought both decisions were inappropriate. And when Sawyer asked if John Jones had made them, Polanco said yes. Since Lynch had ruled that the defense could bring in two additional yogurt shop confessions, Sawyer called on Mike Huckabee to describe the interrogation of Alex Briones and read his statement. Then he called on John Jones, who, though still enraged by Sawyer's implication that he'd botched the crime scene, did the same with regard to his questioning of Sean Buddha Smith. When asked, he also agreed with Polanco that holdback information had quickly begun coming back at us at such a frequency to where we had to cross things off the list. For instance, Amy having been shot twice and the other girls once, the ice scoop between Sarah's legs, front door locked, back door ajar, the dead girls bound and gagged, two of them stacked on top of each other. People knew. Described by Lynch as an explosive witness, Jones quickly exited the courtroom, still flaming. When I asked him to talk to Sawyer in 2014, he refused. "I'd rather talk to Hector," he said, "and you know how I feel about Hector." Sawyer then moved on to Irma Rios. Did she know that Rachel Riffey had not dusted either of the customer bathrooms for fingerprints, and that DPS photographs showed that both of those doors were closed during the fire? No. Had she ordered an inventory of materials within the yogurt shop so that, for instance, if someone said he'd taken a knife from the shop, they would know if a knife was missing? No. Had anyone created a log that anybody who entered the shop had to sign? No. Could she tell the jury what had happened to the steel shelves against the wall? No. The aluminum ladder? No. The mop, the wooden ladder, the mop bucket, the melted telephone, had any of those items been gathered and stored as evidence? No. Had she laid out a grid, as she'd testified earlier, so she could use its coordinates as a reference? No. Did her handbook suggest that she do so? She wasn't sure. Had DPS examined the contents of the dumpster in the alley? They'd looked at what was on top. The judge released the jury early. Having decided not to recall Merrill, Sawyer promised to finish within 48 hours, by noon Friday, May 25th. Expert witness Gerald Hurst might have been the most intriguing Springsteen witness to take the stand. Scientist, chemist, inventor, born and reared in Oklahoma, he'd been awarded a fellowship to study chemistry at Cambridge, where he'd gotten his PhD. Back in the United States, he focused on high-energy chemistry, explosives, incendiaries, propellants, napalm. Having begun his professional life as a rocket scientist after the first successful moon landing, he moved into corporate warfare. During the Vietnam War, his job was to show U.S. troops how to destroy infrastructure behind enemy lines, legal arson, he calls it, by setting fires and making them look accidental. After founding his own company in Dallas, he turned out new kinds of explosives, created a second-generation version of liquid paper, and invented the Mylar balloon, then moved on, selling his company and the rights to his inventions. Eccentric and polite, Hearst lived with his wife in a many-windowed house built high in the rocky West Austin Hills. 14 years after a liver transplant, he was ailing, but his mind still sliced through scientific data with alacrity, and his eyes were alive with knowledge and opinions. Tall, thin, with pale skin and long white hair and beard, his appearance suggests a modern Merlin, a wizard of fire and a mesmerizing presence, though it's somewhat suspect in a courtroom setting. Why didn't he have a job? Why didn't he do fire investigations for ATF or some other agency? Did pure science even belong in the courtroom? Hearst had begun testifying in criminal cases in the late 70s, when he realized how often what he calls witchcraft, or the black arts, were still being applied to arson investigations. It didn't take him long to become the go-to defense witness on fire science, receiving many more requests than he could handle. Fire investigators, he makes clear, are trained to search not for the possibility of accident, but for indications of arson. "I could take almost any fire," he has said, "and if I were so inclined, convince a jury it was arson. It's frighteningly simple." When Sawyer asked how much he charged for his services, Dr. Hearst said if he liked the case, nothing. If he didn't, he wouldn't take it. For the yogurt shop jury, and anyone else who'd seen photos of the crime, fire was important, not just for the horrendous injuries to the girls' bodies, but also because of its emotional and imaginative weight. And with no forensic evidence to tie the defendants to this especially hideous aspect of the killings, the state needed to corroborate Mike Scott's version of how it had happened, those cups and napkins. Hearst destroyed Marshall Littleton's analysis of fire dynamics. Not only had the ATF agent based his calculations on an incorrect ceiling height, but he'd used an inappropriate equation to support his revised conclusion. With scientific aplomb and sharp wit, Hearst spoke eloquently of plumes and the percentage of flame taken up by the flicker range. Unlike Littleton, he'd actually visited the ICBY shop and, after taking measurements and photographs, agreed with Melvin Stahl's original theory that the fire was set on the stainless steel shelves and had burst into flames when the combustibles exploded, then quickly spread across the ceiling, growing hot enough to reach 1200 degrees Fahrenheit and melt the top steps of the aluminum ladder and send a blast of hot gases down on the girls' bodies. Their burns were the result of radiant heat. And yes, certainly, radiation was capable of causing that much damage. After calling two other forensic scientists, a pathologist and a DNA lab technician, Sawyer turned to Richard Offshee, a renowned social psychologist from UC Berkeley. Author of many scholarly books and articles, including seminal works on the recovered memory scandals of the 1980s, and probably the country's best-known expert on false confessions, he was there to explain how these happen. But Offshee was a terrible witness, arrogant, preachy, and long-winded, who clashed with Lynch almost immediately. Initially patient, the judge soon termed social psychology a soft science and warned him to be brief in his comments and answer only the questions asked of him. He also limited his testimony to a description of how police interrogations worked without drawing conclusions. In Texas, Lynch said, conclusions were the responsibility of the jury. Barely concealing his disdain for the judge and how things were done in Texas, Offshee agreed to comply. An undergraduate psych major, Bettis, conducted the direct, during which he repeatedly asked his witness for brevity. But, like many academics, Offshey couldn't resist the chance to lecture. When he wandered far afield, Smith objected, and Lynch sustained. Bettis struggled to rein him in, and Smith's objection was again sustained. After an hour or so of this, Lynch sent the jury out, and the two sides made a deal. Smith agreed to call off his cross-examination if the defense simply asked Offshey to step down. The jury would go to lunch and return to find this aggravation gone. The defense had little choice but to agree, even though Offshey had been expensive. "Disaster," says Sawyer. That night, the resentful expert gave television and newspaper interviews. In his opinion, he said, Springsteen had been coerced, and he couldn't fathom why he was asked to step down. After all, he had testified in Texas trials before. Conventional wisdom decrees that, guilt or innocence regardless, you never put a defendant on the stand, thereby leaving him open to an aggressive cross-examination, except perhaps during the punishment phase of a trial, following a conviction. So when Rob told his lawyers he wanted to tell his story himself, Sawyer and his colleagues debated the wisdom of this, especially since it hadn't gained him any positive traction in the past. But Rob insisted. This was his life, his mess. On Friday, May 25th, against the advice of the others, Sawyer summoned his final witness, the defendant himself, Robert Burns Springsteen IV. Lynch quickly called Sawyer to the bench. Surely he didn't want this to happen in front of the jury. Leaving his client at the mercy of Robert Smith? Sawyer told the judge he had no choice, that Springsteen had insisted. The prosecutors were stunned. In a private conversation, one of them told a victim's family member that they weren't prepared. Smith had to rustle up a plan. Lynch asked Springsteen if he was sure he wished to testify. "Yes, sir," he said. So he was sworn in. Wearing khaki pants and a dark blue long-sleeved dress shirt buttoned to the neck, he took the stand. He looked terrible, his skin blemished, pale and puffy, his goatee unkempt and skimpy. When Sawyer reminded him of his Fifth Amendment rights, he said yes, sir, they'd informed him about that. Under Sawyer's careful questioning, Rob did fairly well. When asked why he'd admitted having done something so terrible if he didn't, he said he guessed he'd given up on himself. He was exhausted from lack of sleep and really thought he had asked for a lawyer. And when things went on, he started to make stuff up, thinking they'd let him go home if he gave them what they wanted. And once they did, he'd hire a lawyer and take a lie detector test in West Virginia to clear himself. Then he'd be fine. That was the easy part. When Robert Smith went to work on him, Springsteen tried holding his own, but when asked if it was just a lucky guess that he knew all those details about the murders, and how he and Mike Scott had come up with the same story, Springsteen said only, "I wouldn't call it a lucky guess." No more questions. The defense rested. This being a Friday, everybody got the weekend off. Lynch would deliver his charge to the jury for the lawyer's approval on Monday, May 28th. On Tuesday, jurors should show up with a suitcase packed for an overnight stay, and, after closing statements, would begin deliberations, which would probably extend into the next day. Court adjourned. Springsteen to Sawyer. "I'm a dead man, aren't I?" Sawyer to Springsteen. "Yes, son, I'm afraid you are." Pretty much everybody thinks Sawyer did the wrong thing by failing to convince the defendant not to testify. Some even point out that if a lawyer can't talk a client out of doing something stupid, he'd better find a new profession. Sawyer says he was convinced the whole thing would be overturned anyway. And was Springsteen glad he'd taken the stand? Honestly, no, I'm not. Back then, at the time, I thought there was no other way to win because I didn't want to go through the 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever year appeal process. So I was like, all right, we gotta do what we gotta do now. And that was a bad decision. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't particularly in my favor either. We were sitting on the screened-in back porch of his mother's house in West Virginia. He was smoking a cigarette. My little dog, Walter, was curled at my feet. It was early spring, and I'd arrived a little late, having driven from Baltimore to cross lanes through patches of dense mountain fog. The afternoon was gray, damp, and misty, too cold to sit on the porch, but we had privacy there, and a big screen television was on inside with the sound up high. Somebody I wasn't introduced to was watching Kill Bill. This was one of 6 identical 2-story houses built on a hillside cul-de-sac. Through the back screen, we could see a very wet green landscape, bushes, grass, and other backyards. A small tree stood by the screen door. Robert said it was a flowering peach, that he'd planted it for his mother. When asked if it was his decision to testify, he said, "Well, it was. The way things came down, or at least the way I understood that things came down, there was some miscommunication between all the different attorneys working on the case, and I misunderstood, had a misconception or whatever it is I had. I thought, okay, look, this is the last chance we got. The ship's sinking. These people, the jurors, are definitely going to be like, okay, you know what? Screw this guy, unless we hear something from him." And Robert Smith was smooth enough to make me look like a moron, honestly. And if it had been a different prosecuting attorney, maybe it would have been a different story. You know, I have a lot of respect for Robert Smith. He was a very good district attorney officer, and he was doing what he was ordered to do, and everybody's like, "Don't you hate the situation and hate the people?" Well, no, some of them I don't have particularly kind feelings for, but I don't hate them, because they were doing what they thought was right or what they were ordered to do. It's like being in the military. Follow orders or you lose your job or your position. I tried to speak with him one day in court. Me and Jim talked about that after the fact. I was like, "Good morning, Robert. How are you today?" And he turned around and looked at me and said, "I'm not allowed to speak to you." "Right on, man. Whatever. Okay." And Jim was like, "Yeah, he's really not supposed to. But a non-anything good morning, how you doing today kind of greeting?" He reacted like that because he knows he's doing you wrong. He's screwing you over. It was his job. And he couldn't see me as a person. All he could see was what he was presenting me as, and what the media wanted to see, and what the public wanted to see. So I guess I became the infamous bad guy. Just inside the front door of the house was a display of family photos, including one of Rob in his mother's lap at about 2 years old. Blonde and chubby, he looked happy and sweet. To use his term, a normal baby. "Those people don't know me," Rob had said many times. "I'm not a bad person. I'm a normal guy. I wouldn't do anything like that." He was utterly polite to me, but when I ask myself if well-mannered people who characterize themselves as normal are capable of committing terrible acts of violence, I remind myself what Jones said about who could or would do such a thing. That, legally speaking, the question's irrelevant. And as for the answer, isn't it obvious given the case of, say, Ted Bundy? And I know he's right, even though the standards we use to determine guilt, probable and without reasonable doubt, are subjective, shifty, and sometimes speculative. Springsteen, closing arguments, verdict, punishment. Sometimes a story feels like it's over long before the credits roll. Middle of the movie, halfway through a scene, we know. On Tuesday, May 29th, 14 jurors showed up with suitcases and Lynch gave his charge. The state would make first and last closing arguments, defense in between. Darla Davis would speak first, then Bettis and Sawyer. Robert Smith would have the last word. If courtroom lawyers are in general agreement about any one thing, it's that you don't give your closing from notes and certainly not from a prepared text. You plan ahead, rehearse, revise, rehearse again, and then extemporize, engaging jurors with your passionate certainty and moving a soulful gaze from one to the next. But this case broke the mold in many respects. Darla Davis read her statement, and Burke Bettis talked from notes for the first time in his 25-year career. Sawyer, of course, spoke off the cuff. But when he strayed a few minutes over his time limit, Lynch cut him short. An unusual move when a man's life was on the line. Never happened to him before, Sawyer says. He drew his statement to an abrupt close, wondering, as if to himself, if people really wanted to find someone guilty of a crime with no real evidence to support the decision. Robert Smith described Amy Ayers crawling across the storeroom floor, hoping to save herself, as a merciless Robert Springsteen fired the shot that ended her life. "Ladies and gentlemen," he concluded, "you are sitting in the courtroom with the man who killed Amy Ayers, the man who will be sitting here when you return with your verdict." Nobody was brilliant. Everybody was good. Everything had already been said. At a little before 1 o'clock, Lynch sent the jury off to elect a foreman and commence deliberations. He informed the two alternate jurors of their status, which they hadn't heard until that moment, then thanked them for their service and sent them home. At 5, the jurors asked to review Chandra Morgan's testimony. After the court reporter read it to them, they returned to the jury room and remained there until 7, when Lynch called an end to their day's work. A shuttle van transported them to a local motel. The next morning they gathered again. After a couple of hours, they asked for a readback of Springsteen's testimony. In the middle of the afternoon, they sent word they were ready. At 3:55, the court reconvened without Sawyer. He says he hadn't thought the jury would come in that day. Some think he had other reasons. Before Rob entered the courtroom, Bettis paid him a visit. The jurors were crying, he told him, which wasn't a good sign. Spectators, victims' families, and the press had gathered, but the row reserved for Springsteen remained empty except for his grandmother, Mary Jane Roudbush, who had attended his trial regularly, always wearing a red or pink hairpiece. For the verdict, she'd switched to black. At 4:05, Lynch read the verdict. Guilty as charged. The foreman affirmed the unanimity of the vote. Relieved, families of the victims sobbed and held one another. Jurors wept. Springsteen looked straight ahead. Lynch adjourned the court until the next morning, when the punishment phase would begin. The bailiff escorted the inmate back to county jail as photos were snapped. Reporters rushed to file stories. Family members embraced detectives. "One down," Merrill commented. The next day, Austin attorney Joe Turner told the Statesman that this case appeared from all angles to be a defense case, described Lynch's decision to let the jury hear Scott's confession as pivotal, and said he thought that allowing Springsteen to take the stand was a desperate attempt to counter its admission. He attributed the outcome largely to the preparation and skills of Robert Smith. Under Texas law, when considering punishment in a capital case, a jury has to respond to three special issues. First, is there a probability that the defendant will commit future acts of violence that would constitute a continuing threat to society, including within a prison setting? Second, taking into consideration the circumstances of the offense and the defendant's character and background, are there sufficient mitigating circumstances to warrant a sentence of life imprisonment rather than the death penalty? Third, did the convicted person intentionally kill the victim of the offense? A vote of yes, no, yes would send Rob Springsteen to death row. If jurors said no to the first question, they weren't required to answer the second two. At the time, the Texas Penal Code didn't allow for a sentence of life without parole, so the prosecution and defense had agreed that, should the jury sentence Springsteen to life in prison, he would serve a mandatory 35 years, including time served, before being granted a parole hearing. After explaining those options to the jury, Lynch called on the state to make its case for what it considered appropriate punishment. To show that Yogurt Shop wasn't an anomaly but part of an ongoing pattern of antisocial and violent behavior, the prosecution called a number of young men from West Virginia to testify to Springsteen's short fuse, his habitual drunkenness, and the guns and knives they'd seen him carry and sometimes use to threaten people. One told of how Rob had kicked the bug shield of his pickup truck, scaring him so badly that he had to go after him with a nightstick. Another related a similar story of sudden and arbitrary violence. "I never did do nothing to him," he testified. "I'd never seen him, never heard of him, or nothing." Former McCallum High School principal Penny Miller spoke with some compassion and regret about Rob's time at McCallum and how she had failed to reach him. "We didn't succeed with all kids," she admitted. "We didn't with Rob." A West Virginia policeman testified to an incident in 1995 when, during a DUI arrest, Springsteen became violent, resisted arrest, and tried to kick several officers. Another described an arrest for disorderly conduct when Rob told the cops, "Fuck it, take me to jail." James Ramsbottom from Charleston described a night way back in 1990 when he was a doorman at a nightclub and Rob appeared wearing a long dark coat and asked Ramsbottom to hold a gun for him, a 9mm that could be converted to a semi-automatic. He also remembered Rob with a 380 and other guns, bragging about crimes he'd committed. During cross, this witness admitted to Sawyer that he was still on probation from a felony charge. The last witness for the prosecution was Bob Ayers, who once again told tender stories about his daughter, how talented she was at riding and training horses, how much she loved cats, dogs, horses, rabbits, and her FFA animals, how happy she made her family, how much they missed her. Robert Smith had photographs of a smiling, cowboy-hatted Amy projected onto the video screen, then announced that the prosecution rested. Now it was time for the defense to mitigate those troubling testimonies. They might have presented witnesses to testify to Springsteen's basic strength of character and respect for life, his work ethic, and his steadiness as a husband and stepfather, whatever they could come up with that might convince the jury that his life was worth sparing. They might have brought in a West Virginia psychologist to testify to the debilitating effects of his learning disabilities. His grandmother had gone home, saying she wouldn't testify because she knew she'd cry and didn't want to cry in front of those girls' parents. But his mother had taken her place and might have been asked to talk about Rob as a child, much as Bob Ayers had about Amy. The defense might have projected the photo I saw much later of a blonde, smiling baby in his mother's lap. Robert's wife might have told the jury about the good and gentle man she married. Bettis might have taken the stand to speak of Rob's honest desire to tell his story on the stand, whatever the risks, and despite his lawyer's advice. The evidence the prosecution had presented to indicate future dangerous behavior was neither strong nor convincing. Nonetheless, Sawyer had to find some